From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and in a moment we'll get some historical context for last night's State of the Union address, but reaction is already coming in today, and NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley joins us from Washington with that. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And it seems like the polls are indicating that Republicans loved the speech, independents liked it, Democrats did not like it.
Yeah, kind of typical of these very polarized times that we're in. Even though the president paid at least lip service to bipartisanship and cooperation, there's just not a lot of deep reservoir of that sort of sentiment here in Washington.
President Trump made some news in the speech when he announced he would meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for a second summit later this month in Vietnam. But then he raised some eyebrows with this statement. Let's listen.
As part of a bold new diplomacy, we continue our historic push for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped. And there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected President of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
Now, many of his own experts on the subject say North Korea is not doing anything right now to actually denuclearize, which is part of the deal that they made. How can he make such a statement that we'd be in a major war with North Korea if he weren't president?
This is not the first time Donald Trump has said that. Actually, last night he did qualify it, at least saying that's his opinion. It's obviously not an opinion that is widely shared. You can hear the groans from some of the Democrats in the chamber there. Remember, this is a president who spent part of 2017 comparing the size of his nuclear button to that of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, calling the North Korean leader Little Rocket Man, talking about fire and fury, before he shifted gears and adopted this more diplomatic tone. As you say, even though he's all in on diplomacy now and is planning this second summit with Kim Jong-un in Vietnam later this month, his own intelligence experts say that the gains that the president likes to trumpet about, you know, a suspension in missile test and nuclear test are, in their view, temporary, and they just don't believe that North Korea is going to get rid of its nuclear weapons because they believe the regime sees them as necessary to its own survival.
Scott, this speech was delayed because of the government shutdown, which was going on because of disagreement over the president's idea for a border wall. There is another shutdown looming next week if they can't reach a deal. President Trump talked about border security. He said there was a tremendous onslaught of migrants coming into the country. He was talking about caravans again. Didn't sound like something that was going to lead to some bipartisan deal in the next week.
No, not particularly. And that section of the speech sounded a lot like the speech he gave from the Oval Office in the midst of that government shutdown. That speech didn't do much to move the needle in terms of public sentiment. It certainly didn't free up additional funds for the president's proposed border wall. This was another opportunity for him to make the case. He's going to do it again on Monday when he's holding a Trump rally in El Paso, one of the cities where he said, you know, an existing wall has been successful. But it doesn't sound as if the president's moved very much, and certainly doesn't seem as if Democrats have moved very far either.
The president also fired off a warning to Democrats suggesting that if they want to work with him, they should end the investigations. Here he is.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
Now, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, balked when he said that, and it was pointed out that Richard Nixon called for an end to the Watergate investigation in his State of the Union address in 1974, just months before he resigned.
Yeah, the president also suggested that investigations could actually imperil the U.S. economy, which is a particularly sort of extortionist threat. Democrats aren't buying it. They plan to proceed with their oversight responsibility, and the investigations will continue.
NPR's fact checkers were monitoring the speech in real time last night. Scott, they must have been pretty busy.
There's a whole lot of fact checks. You can read all about it at NPR.org.
That is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He always gives us some context. Julian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And start with what we were just hearing, the president last night talking about ending investigations, just as President Nixon did, asking to end the investigations into Watergate in his speech, 1974. What is that? Does that tell you that President Trump did not have a seasoned speechwriter who wouldn't have picked up on that? Or what does that tell you?
Yeah, it was very odd to hear him compare himself through those words to Richard Nixon in his final year. This is the year Nixon would resign a few months later. So I don't know if it's having bad speechwriters or his not having a good sense of history. I do think there's a part of him that also likes that Nixon fight, the fight against the press, the fight against his opponents, and might want to selectively take part of Nixon's legacy while leaving out the other very big and obvious aspect of how it all ended.
Well, it's so interesting you say that because we know Roger Stone, his close associate, who's now been indicted, adored Richard Nixon, has his tattoo on his back and, of course, gave those Nixonian salutes as he kept leaving the courtroom last week. But you continued the Nixon-era references in something you wrote on the CNN.com last night. You wrote, "The State of the Union is not good," to paraphrase Gerald Ford, who, of course, followed in the presidency after Richard Nixon stepped down and is one of the first presidents to ever say that in the opening remarks, the State of the Union is not good. Remind us of that context.
Yeah, I think when he said it, it was a little too honest for the country, meaning the economy was doing terribly at that point. The nation was still trying to get over the fact that a president had resigned, and we were still trying to get over Vietnam. And that was very blunt and didn't sit well. For me, President Trump was doing the opposite. He was acting as if this was a political world that's totally at odds with who he's been as president and with the incredible divisive partisan approach that he's adopted. I think the State of the Union is not good is an accurate statement of our politics today, but he was trying to present something different last night.
Well, you say the drama over his speech ignores the realities of this presidency, as you just said. He is a divider. He's a fierce partisan. But as we just heard, Republicans love the speech. We spoke to a Trump voter yesterday. The prayer was that he would ask for unity. So he did. I mean, does he get points for that?
Well, he was trying to get Republican unity. I think it was a very partisan speech in that he wanted to shore up support among Republicans, including those who are wavering a bit on supporting him, given that the person behind him was a Democratic speaker. And at the same time, he had those parts of the speech that went right to the hardcore base, the immigration and the abortion parts, and also the attacks on socialism. So it was a message aimed at doing what it accomplished. So yes, he might have helped at least temporarily strengthen the resolve of his own Republican Party. He didn't win over Democrats. And I don't think any temporary gains he made with independents will hold very long, because by the end of today or tomorrow, I'm sure he'll be exactly where he was before the speech, tweeting and saying things that are meant to provoke.
Well, as you pointed out, by the end of yesterday, he was. He had a luncheon yesterday?
Yes.
Yeah, and with TV anchors.
Exactly. And he attacked Joe Biden and called the former vice president stupid. He had nasty words for Chuck Schumer, with whom he's going to have to negotiate. So I think, you know, you have to look at this speech, but you have to remember everything we've been seeing right through that lunch. That's the reality of what the president is about. And I don't think the speech can be taken for anything more than that.
Well, look, but again, his core voters and Republicans are, they're applauding it. But did you feel just in the deliverance that there was a bit of a disconnect? I mean, we suddenly found ourselves lurching from we're going to end HIV in our lifetime, which was laudable, but something we haven't heard from this administration. And then suddenly childhood cancer, again, something we've never heard. And World War II veterans, noble, and we're not going to be able to showcase them much longer. But others have pointed out he continuously drew attention to the World War II veterans or the Holocaust survivors in the balcony, while, frankly, he's kind of taking apart the world order that those veterans fought to build after World War II.
There's lots of disconnects. There's lots of inconsistencies. But it's not unlike the speeches we hear him give all the time. He has different things in his mind that he puts together, and they're logical to him. He clearly wanted to try to hearken back to a little bit of Ronald Reagan's messages in the 1980s about American greatness. But he's using examples which are antithetical to the policies he's promoting. So yes, he's looking back to World War II as a key moment as we allied with other nations to fight against terrible evil. Yeah. Yet as president, he's tearing apart some of those very alliances. Look, he was also talking about anti-Semitism and pointing to a survivor at the Tree of Life. In a same speech, he used the rhetoric about the caravan and immigrants that the shooter used. Mm. So those contradictions were all over the place. But that's not something that bothers him. He's not encumbered by consistency or those
Julian,
kind of arguments.
I just have to ask you real quick, we have 30 seconds. Yep. Is the State of the Union a bit broken? Because there were a lot of untruths in the speech.
It's broken, but it's still important. Anytime we can hear from a president and evaluate a president, it's still better than total silence. So it's broken, but it's still valuable.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, also co-author of the new book, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
The music streaming giant Spotify is making a big bet on podcasts. Spotify announced today that it is buying Gimlet, along with another podcast company, Anchor. There are reports the price tag is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Spotify CEO Daniel Ek said in a statement today that these acquisitions will meaningfully accelerate Spotify's path to becoming the world's leading audio platform. Joining us now is Peter Kafka. He's executive editor at Recode. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
And so what is Spotify's vision here in grabbing up these podcast companies?
Spotify's vision broadly is they want to be more than just a music company. For a while, they talked about video. They tried to get into video. It didn't really work. And I think more or less they've stumbled into the idea that podcasting could be a big business for them. It's a side business for people like Apple. But for them, it's much more important. So what they've done is gone ahead and bought a company, Gimlet, that can help them make their own podcasts, and a company, Anchor, that can help distribute them.
How lucrative are podcasts, though? At this point, it seems like maybe a handful of podcasts that are at the very top of the charts are able to be sustainable financially, but otherwise, no.
It's a small business, $300-ish million last year, which is nothing in the greater advertising business, which is maybe like $88 billion for digital ads. They're pretty cheap to make. And I think Spotify's thought is, well, we have 207 million users, 206 million users, I think are today's numbers. We can distribute podcasts to a lot of people who aren't listening to them, and we can control some of that inventory, control the costs, and whatever money we do make will come to us. And the other argument, by the way, is that podcasting is a fast-growing business. So even though people like you and I are likely familiar with it, a lot of people haven't heard a podcast before, aren't listening to many of them, and advertisers are interested in them but aren't spending much money, but that'll be growing fast. So Spotify wants to keep a piece of that.
And are the podcasts that are run by the companies that Spotify is picking up, are they going to be available only on Spotify?
No, I talked to the company about that this morning. Right now, everything that Gimlet, which is the main podcast producer they bought, makes should be widely available. Over time, though, Spotify does want to sort of create its own hit podcasts, keep them for themselves. It still expects that most of the podcasts that you can get on Spotify will be available other places. The majority of the stuff will be non-exclusive, but they do want a few hits, the head compared to the tail, as the CFO put it to me this morning.
What does this mean for Spotify's competitors? I was reading that Spotify revealed that it has 207 million monthly active users, which dwarfs Apple Music's 50 million.
Apple Music's number is a paid number, so the apples-to-apples number there is I think, 96 million paid users for Spotify. Mm-hmm. Apple is interested in the music business, is interested in subscriptions in general, so that's a nice part of it for them. It's not crucial for them. You can see where they're paying attention. They're spending more than $1 billion to buy and build TV shows and movies. That's what Apple really cares about. Music is a sidelight for them. Podcast is a sidelight of a sidelight. It's a very small thing for Apple. I don't think this is going to concern them very much.
Do you think that this is going to get more people who are using Spotify to listen to podcasts, or is the idea to get people who are interested in podcasts to start listening to more music, or both?
I think what Spotify wants is people who are already listening to podcasts to listen to more podcasts on Spotify. I think especially now that it's investing hundreds of millions of dollars, is it up to $500 million this year on startups all in, that it will make podcasts much more front and center in the app experience. I think they'll promote them much more aggressively because it will want people who aren't listening to podcasts now to listen to them. It'd be happy to bring more people who are listening to podcasts already over there as well. But I think its idea is, look, when we expose people to podcasts, they stick around Spotify more, they use it more, they're more likely to keep subscribing. That's what we want.
That is Peter Kafka, who is executive editor at Recode. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, the polar vortex is gone for now, but if it comes back, our resident chef Kathy Gunst has something to warm you up with. She wants to talk about cabbage. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I do want to talk cabbage.
Okay, so this is a kind of food that I never think of when I'm trying to decide what to make.
It's not that popular, but I hope in the next few minutes I convince you otherwise. I mean, okay, just think of a few things. Sauerkraut. Coleslaw,
yep.
Corned beef and cabbage, tacos with cabbage,
right.
Roasted cabbage, stir-fried, braised, stuffed cabbage. It shows up in recipes all over the world, but it's not sexy. It's not sexy food. People think of it as like, oh, no, I don't want that.
I think of like German beer house.
Yeah,
with like
exactly.
Your cabbage and bratwurst or something.
So
like that.
I wanted to tell you a story. So when I was a kid, we certainly had coleslaw on deli sandwiches and sauerkraut on hot dogs, but it seemed stinky to me, you know? Like
right.
It just what? So I was lucky enough in 1977,
okay.
I went to Bologna, Italy with Marcella Hazan. And she had a red cabbage in front of her. It was the first day of class. I was there learning about her and writing a story. And she simmered the cabbage in red wine. And I thought, seriously? I came to Italy for pasta and, you know,
right.
all these luscious foods. And she's
right.
making a cabbage. And about 2 hours later, the cabbage had transformed into this silky, earthy, beautiful, beautiful dish. And all of a sudden I'm like, okay, cabbage, I think I get the possibilities. So one of the dishes I made for you is a nod to Marcella Hazan. This is a version of a recipe of hers where you braise chicken in red cabbage with red wine, garlic, and onions, and it cooks for over an hour until the meat just falls off the bone.
It's like a coq au vin with
that
cabbage.
That is exactly right, Jeremy. And it's, I didn't even think of it, right? Until I was coming in, I'm like, wait, coq au vin, that's
Jeremy's
his favorite food.
Yep.
But the cabbage adds a sweetness to it, and it kind of melts. It's not super identifiable as cabbage. Mm. I made it with red cabbage. You could certainly make it with white cabbage or any type of cabbage. But I love this dish. It's a perfect winter main course, cozy, cold night. It's comfort food.
Yeah, it warms you up.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, up next, you have brought us what looks like a soup here.
It is a soup. Cabbage lends itself beautifully to soup. I made a winter root vegetable soup. It's got parsnips in it and carrots and onion and garlic, and it's a chicken broth base. You could easily do it with a vegetable broth. Lots of red cabbage. I added a little bit of Savoy cabbage, and we can get into the differences.
Did you put a little cheese on top of here?
A little bit of grated Parmesan. It also has some linguica sausage.
Oh, wow.
Which gives it a slight spiciness. Sausage and cabbage are a beautiful combination. So I thought, ooh, root vegetables, sweet, earthy, little bit of spice, little bit of meat, and then this wonderful cabbage.
I feel like if you had a little bit of a cold, this would help.
Are you kidding? You would be instantly
cured.
It's
like a chicken noodle soup, but with cabbage in it.
Yeah, and all those good vegetables. There's
right.
no way that's not going to make you feel good.
Okay, and what about this one? This is like a bok choy.
This is bok choy. So cabbage is a leafy green, red, or white vegetable. It's grown annually. It's called a cruciferous vegetable, and it belongs to the brassica family. Broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, bok choy are all related to it. So these are baby bok choy that were grown in New England, and I steamed them for 1 minute, and then I stir-fried them with lots of fresh ginger and scallions, and on your plate is hoisin sauce.
And just forgive me while I try to use chopsticks while you're talking.
There is a fork and a knife somewhere over there. I love bok choy. It's subtle as far as cabbages go, and it's a little bit sweet, and this is the simplest. It's a 3-minute dish. It's a 1-minute steam and a 2 or 3 minute stir fry.
How do you buy cabbage? How do you know what's the good one to buy?
You want something that's firm, shiny leaves, no bruises, and it will keep for a good 2 weeks in the refrigerator. You don't want to cover it unless for some reason you've cut a cabbage in half and you have half to refrigerate. But there are many different types of cabbages, and most people tend to just know the green cabbage. That's the stuff you see in the grocery store. Also want to point out, this stuff is very inexpensive. It is a hearty meal that can go a long way for not a lot of money. So think of a green cabbage as like the Honda of cabbages. It's like, you know, reliable. It's everywhere. It's out there. You can stir fry it. You can use it in slaws or salad. And they can go from being kind of small to being almost the size of a basketball. There's also red cabbage, which I'm a big fan of. It's just like green cabbage, except for the color. Also has a bit of a sweetness and, again, is very good raw or cooked. And then it goes on. Savoy cabbage is gorgeous. It has a like a waffle knit texture to the leaves. It's kind of ruffled and it's used a lot in French cooking. The leaves are big, so they're great for stuffing. I loved stuffed cabbage. It's a classic Eastern European and Jewish dish. Napa cabbage is quite different. It's sometimes called Chinese cabbage, and it doesn't look like a head of cabbage. It's elongated, it's light green leaves, and it's super crunchy. Again, great in stir fries, or you can use the cabbage leaf as like a taco shell. You could stir fry pork or chicken and put a filling into
like
a raw
lettuce
leaf.
Wrap, basically.
Yes, exactly. But it gives it a great, and it's also used quite a bit in spicy kimchi.
So, Kathy, with all of these amazing things about cabbage that you're telling us about, why do you think it's not more popular?
I am not sure, because the other thing we haven't talked about are the health benefits. I mean, you would think that if you ate cabbage every day, you would never get any disease for the rest of your life. You name it, and it supposedly keeps that away. It's kind of insane. I think it's considered peasant food, and we're predisposed to thinking that things that have a bit of an odor are inexpensive and are connected to peasant cooking are somehow not desirable. But I would think it's exactly the opposite. That chicken and red cabbage stew to me is like the finest food you can eat. I just fell in love with it this past week, cooking all these different things for you. And I think people will be really surprised to see how versatile it is.
Well, again, you can find the recipes for all of these, including this coq au vin cabbage, we'll call it, or cabbage coq au vin, at hereandnow.org. Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And last night, in his State of the Union address, President Trump made this surprise announcement.
My budget will ask Democrats and Republicans to make the needed commitment to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the United States within 10 years. We have made incredible strides. Incredible.
Well, activists' heads were spinning. In 2017, Trump fired his entire HIV-AIDS Advisory Council, and his administration has tried to cut money for HIV-AIDS programs in past budgets. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has been learning more. Selena, hi.
Hi.
And we know this is a big problem. We're based in Boston. They've reported 6 new cases of HIV infections from drug injections just since November. It's a problem across the country. Today, Health and Human Services officials spoke with reporters. Did we learn anything more?
Right. So President Trump was pretty brief in his remarks during the State of the Union. And today we got some more details from officials from Health and Human Services. Admiral Brett Girouard was asked about the budget and this administration's history of cutting programs related to HIV. And he said he wouldn't talk specifics since the budget isn't out yet, but he did say this.
We are very confident we will have the sufficient resources provided in the 2020 budget for us to begin this very aggressive plan.
So certainly to execute on a plan this big, it would cost billions of dollars, and administration officials sound like they think they can get that.
Yeah, well, the part of it apparently is to focus on geographic hotspots across 48 counties where this has been tough to get rid of. What more can you tell us?
Right. So they're talking about public health initiatives that experts in HIV have known are the most effective tools for a really long time, like using prophylactic medication and condoms and clean needle programs to prevent the spread of HIV, and also getting people who have HIV diagnosed early and on effective treatment. And that really reduces transmission as well. Mm. So the kinds of things that they're talking about implementing in those hotspots you mentioned are tools that have been in the public health toolbox for a long time. But they're saying that what's new here is a cross-agency push to really put these tools in place and fund them adequately.
Yeah. Look, under Trump's 2019 budget proposal, there's a recommendation to eliminate education centers and special project programs under the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, named after the young man who died of the disease. And also you have House Speaker Nancy Pelosi putting out a statement after the State of the Union saying, the president's call for ending HIV transmission in America is interesting, but if he's serious about ending the HIV/AIDS crisis, he must end his assault on healthcare and the dignity of the LGBTQ community. What's the sense? I mean, first of all, why this shift? Do we know?
Well, I think that the people in the administration who are behind this effort include people who really have a lot of credibility in the fight against HIV. Dr. Redfield is one of them, and Brett Giroir. These are people who, experts in HIV and advocacy, say really do have the credibility and the knowledge to be able to pull this off. And I think that they're leading the charge, and the president thinks that maybe with Pelosi's history, he can get a compromise and he can get a win.
Well, and her history of being active in this arena. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin, we'll keep an eye on this for sure. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Marion Hodges is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. She is with us once again. Hi, Marion.
Hi, Jeremy. It's so great to be here.
It's great to have you. And let's start with the group X-Hex. This is called Cosmic Cave. This is actually a trio from D.C., right?
Correct, yes. And if that doesn't warm you up, I don't know what will. That is just, I feel like that song is just a pure burst of energy. And every time I hear it, I'm like, I can take on the entire world. I can do anything.
Now, this is three women. Is that typical in the world of punk?
No, not so much. That's something that makes it even more special. Yeah, anytime you get a really good punk rock female supergroup, it's just, it's a wonderful and all too rare, but you know, we're going in a better direction with that sort of sight to behold. And actually, I was noticing this morning as I was kind of making my notes, it's a very female-centric list of songs that
good.
I put together
good.
For you today.
All right. Well, let's get to the next one. This is Quattro Crazy. This is by the group E La Bamba. Sound there. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this is Ila Bamba's fifth album, and the primary singer-songwriter is a woman named Luz Elena Mendoza, and she's calling this new album Mujeres, Spanish for women. So again, just really sticking to that female-centric theme, and this one just immediately drew me in. It has that sort of just slightly off-kilter, dizzy, hypnotic quality where you're like, ooh, what is this melody? What is she saying? I'm so interested in this. But the whole thing overall is very light and airy. It keeps going in that path, and then by the end, she's just basically singing la-di-da, la-di-da, and it's you're kind of like, what? There's so much going on here. I'm into all of it.
And they're from Portland.
Yes, Portland, Oregon, a hotbed of indie rock. So lots of great bands, lots of a great musical scene up there, and Ila Bamba, a big shining part of that.
Okay, the next one that you brought us is Shelter. This is by Christina O.
Do I be shelter? Do I be what keeps you warm? Do I be shelter that you use to weather the storm? Do I be shelter when you leave? That's all that I'm good for. You know when it rains, it pours on me too. Will you be umbrella? 'Cause I need affection, I need protection too. Yet I calm you when I'm the one who's drowning. What if being selfless is neglecting too? Do you hear me?
Okay, yet again, you have brought us something that is really unusual in the sense that Christina O is 19 years old.
That is correct.
That's amazing. And we've had 17-year-olds, we've had 18-year-olds, but this is just incredible that these young people are putting out music like this at that age.
I know. Every time I come across one of these artists, I just get a lot of insecurity of like, what was I doing at 19? I was certainly not coming.
My high school
up with anything.
Play was not that good, I think, in retrospect, but yes.
No, and she's a poet as well and a spoken word artist, Christina O. But she's been at it for a while. She talks about wanting to be a musician from the moment she entered consciousness and listening to Aaliyah on her parents' hi-fi. And there's another lyric in the song that the way she delivers it and just the words themselves, it gives me chills and it stops me in my tracks every time. And it's, do you hear me from underneath the covers of my heart? Again, just really incredible stuff. Mm. The EP she has coming out, Girl in Passing, is her first proper official release. And it's just really exciting to see where she's going to go from here.
Okay, let's get to Sharon Van Etten. This is Memorial Day.
Where do you stay?
This song is from her new album, Remind Me Tomorrow. Tell us about why you chose her and this one.
Yes, that new album just came out a couple of weeks ago. I've been a fan of hers for a while, basically since she kind of showed up on the scene. She's just a great singer-songwriter. Another person who just has an incredible way with lyrics and telling a story. And I'm very intrigued by this album. She was working on scoring films, and so she was working on a film in her practice space that she shares with another person and talks about being drawn over to this synthesizer that person has, the Roland Jupiter 4. So the whole album is kind of built around those synthesizer sounds, which is a little bit of an expansion for her and her sound. And I just think the results are incredibly cool.
All right, we have time for one more, and this is called Circle K. It's by Pedro the Lion.
Got a little allowance from
Pedro the Lion is from Arizona. Circle K is a convenience store in the Southwest.
Correct. And extending a little bit into the South proper, I guess, because I remember going to Circle K when I was growing up in Georgia, and that's part of what drew me to the song, because for some reason that was always my favorite convenience store growing up, and I have no idea why. Yes, this is the first album released under the moniker Pedro the Lion since 2004, and the primary force behind the project is a man named David Bazan. He's an incredible singer-songwriter. He does those very deep, very personal explorations. The new album, is named Phoenix after his hometown, and it's all of these. It's basically a collection of short stories about childhood and his teenage years. And his work is always incredible. He's put out several albums under his own name, but having him go back to that Pedro the Lion project, there's just something a little extra special about that. So many of us grew up with that project, and that track that we just heard, Circle K, has that classic indie rock, slow build, and a great story.
Now, how did Pedro the Lion make it into your almost all women list for us today?
That's a very good question. You can't just stick to all women. There's got to be a dude here and there. And if there was going to be one honorary dude on this list, I would just say he fits in.
That is Marion Hodges, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. If you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org. Marion, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A horrible thing happened 2 weeks ago today when a gunman walked into a SunTrust bank in Florida and murdered five women: Marisol Lopez, Jessica Montague, Cynthia Watson, Deborah Cook, and Anna Pinon Williams. It barely made the headlines, so we want to check in. Tim Williams is pastor of Victory Worship Center in Plant City, Florida. Anna Pinon Williams was his brother's wife. Pastor Williams, Tim, obviously, we're so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Yeah. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to share today.
Well, your thoughts on this, because it does strike us that, you know, there was a yoga studio attack in Florida, barely got covered because there's, you know, so much else going on. And because, frankly, we've gotten to the point where a shooting has to rise, you know, and your thoughts on that.
Yes. Well, even though it's not being talked about on national media, our citizens, our families, our churches, you can sense in the city and in the county this coming together, that you can walk into a restaurant and the families are being loved on, they're being served, the churches are serving them. So,
you pulled up to another bank, right? And a teller recognized you as the brother of one of the victims?
Yes, at my home bank, I was recognized by the teller, and they gathered a few of the workers inside and came to the window and expressed their condolences. And this is an hour and a half away from where the event took place. So in this area, it's still very much in people's minds and hearts.
Well, we invited your brother to speak with us. He's not ready. And you have graciously offered to do that. Anna, as you call her, a mother of seven children. They had a blended family, three of her own, stepmom to your brother's four children. And do I understand that for what? I mean, I'm sure you'd say the grace of God, he might have been there as well?
Yes. Chad was at the bank just moments before the shooter came in and brought a lunch to Anna, and just had a wonderful, just a short few moments of exchanging, you know, their love for each other. And I think she mentioned something about him being the best husband in the world, and that was the last words that he heard from her as he left the bank. And then, the best we can tell, within 5 or 10 minutes, the shooter entered the bank. So we're happy that the children didn't lose two parents that day. And we're happy that Chad did get a final memory that was very positive, which a lot of people don't have that privilege.
He's a former law enforcement officer. And I'm wondering if he's also suffering what if I'd been there? Is he suffering from that as well, that maybe he could have done something?
The thought does come into his mind, and he just has to remind himself that our faith is what holds us together in times like this. And the man that committed this atrocious act, he was a trained prison guard.
He was in training.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like he came into this place not knowing how to establish a command presence and take real advantage of this. So, although my brother's former law enforcement, I don't believe that it would have made a difference for him being there, except that we may have lost him as well.
Yeah. Again, the sort of random kind of insanity of it, how do you as a pastor help your congregation with this?
Mainly by understanding that this human condition that we're facing today is absolutely nothing new. You know, I'm in no way qualified to speak to medical conditions that cause mental illness, but I am a human being who has found darkness in my own heart. And we believe that this is the main cause, is this darkness that's in humanity, that each of us bear responsibility for recognizing in ourselves and going to our Creator and asking for His light to shine in us, and so that we can love one another fully. And if we love one another, we will not be killing each other.
Well, in this case, the shooter was said by a former girlfriend to always have hated people, wanted people to die. There were a lot of questions about he had been in, sent to health clinics, questions about how somebody with that background was able to buy a gun. But you're going broader, Pastor Williams. You're saying that love will conquer this. That's a, I'm betting for some of your family members, that's a big ask.
Well, this is not something new for us. Our entire family is a family of faith, and we have been for decades. So we're simply practicing what we've preached. Now, this is not to discount the pain and the sorrow and even the anger that comes when this moment happened. All of us felt all of those things, but we know that the only hope for this is for people to open up and let the light in. Mm-hmm. I believe our leaders are doing the best they can in this country. They don't always agree on the solutions to this, but in reality, we cannot legislate the human heart. And ultimately, it comes down to the decisions people make.
And by the way, our additional condolences to you. You lost your wife last year to health issues. Now your brother, also a widower. Our thoughts to both of you.
Thank you.
That's Tim Williams, pastor at Victory Worship Center in Plant City, Florida. His sister-in-law, Anna Pinon Williams, was one of five women killed in the SunTrust Bank shooting 2 weeks ago. As he said, not fated at all. Tim, Pastor Williams, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.